Once you know your mortality deeply, you will not find it hard to put aside harmful actions, nor difficult to do what is helpful. After that, contemplate for a long time on kindness and compassion. And once these fill your heart, you will no longer find it hard to act for the benefit of yourself and others. So, any responses to those two questions? What gets in the way and makes us forgetful, and what's needed for us to naturalize? Yes. I think you do raise a very important point that I think many probably could relate to, that how often our motivation is crisis-oriented in practice. You know, you have something go wrong, you suddenly meet an illness or a great loss, and you know, there's that sense of, you know, I really need to meet this, except the problem is, of course, that we're under-resourced. And, you know, there's that kind of nautical saying, you know, the times of greatest danger is not when the sea is calm, it's not when the sea is choppy, it's when the sea is calm. Because it is very easy, you know, comfort makes us forgetful, you know, we sort of get a sort of veneer that it's going to stay like this, you know, and then suddenly, of course, impermanence or instability erupts once more into our life, and we suddenly find ourselves unprepared. And for me, it's always been an important question of, you know, I think many people come into practice out of a crisis motivation initially. You know, something's really unsatisfactory and I need to find a way. But of course, forgetfulness is often induced by calmness. But I wonder what it is to have a different motivation in practice, you know, the genuine possibility of depth, the genuine possibility of embodiment, the genuine possibility of coming to the same insights that the Buddha came to, you know, the genuine possibility of knowing, you know, the same courage, the same fearlessness, the same wakefulness. And I wonder how much that is genuinely claimed. Sometimes I wonder at times how much that is genuinely claimed in people's hearts and minds as actually the kind of wholesome aspiration in practice or the foundation of the whole path. You know, the third noble truth often gets forgotten. You know, we know about the first noble truth. Okay, that's in our realm of experience, you know. Sometimes we know the causes, although sometimes we'd rather not know. We do know something about a path, but it's interesting how the fourth noble truth is often really not connected, in my understanding, in people's minds, with the third and noble truth. You know, that there is the end of dukkha, there is the cessation of greed, hatred, delusion, there is nibbana. But it, yeah. And so I just want to. I think that, you know, for me, one of the difference about knowing embodiment is that we don't always, you know, because insights are there. I mean, there's lots of insight in this room, you know. It's not like you're devoid of it. There's lots of insight in this room. And I think always we just don't always take that next step to really say, well, insight has implications. You know, it's not just about knowing on whatever level I know about impermanence. I mean, I might know that really deeply. You know, I might have had startling meditative experiences and life experiences, you know, where I know so deeply about impermanence and change. But then there are implications, you know, because if we really think about it, the knowing of impermanence and instability, it makes an absolute mockery of clinging. Doesn't it? Makes an absolute mockery of clinging. You know, because clinging is basically our argument with impermanence. That's how we try to make things stand still. You know, that's how we might try to make things last. That's how we try to make me stand still, is through clinging identification. So really understanding impermanence means, for me, it means taking that next step around embodiment. The embodiment is the cultivation of the non-clinging mind. Because nothing else makes sense. You know, that's when we stop arguing with the unarguables. You know, but that is a commitment, and that is, you know, that is a practice, and it's a commitment, and it's a huge commitment and a dedication to cultivate the non-clinging mind, because we're so have such a habit of clinging. Mm-hmm. But every moment of clinging, in my understanding, is a moment of forgetfulness about impermanence. It's a moment of forgetting what we actually know. You know, instead of saying, aha, this too will change, this too will pass, the lovely and the unlovely, we say, no, I think I'll make this one stay. And we feel that movement. It's almost as everything that we experience inwardly and outwardly has written on it, just passing through. Just passing through. And, you know, those moments of forgetfulness, of course, do cause suffering. But I think it's so important, you know, we don't actually become familiar enough with the landscape of non-clinging. And that's a taste of that third noble truth. You know, there are lots of moments in our day when clinging is not happening, and we hardly notice them. You know, brushing the teeth, just brushing the teeth, you know. You know, going for a walk, just going for a walk. You know, sitting still, just sitting still. Breathing, just breathing. Listening, just listening. There are many, many moments in our day when non-clinging is happening, and we're not always so prone to investigate those moments as deeply as we are prone to react to the moments of clinging. So I would actually really encourage you to actually notice, bring into the field of your awareness the moments of non-clinging in your day. Begin to get a taste of that mind. Beginning to get a taste of that mind, how it senses the arising and passing of all things. But of course, we also are asked to make ourselves less prone to clinging and contractedness, and more prone to relinquishment. And sometimes this means being willing to go past that first stage of stepping out of busyness, you know. The loneliness also passes. You know, the sense of there being something missing also changes. And beginning to get the taste of that calming and that stilling and that spaciousness. You know, the implications of living in an uncertain and unstable world of conditions, where do we find refuge? You know, in one of the discourses, the Buddha put it so succinctly. He says, it makes no sense that I, who am mortal and changing, try to find a refuge in that which is also mortal, changing, and unstable. It makes perfect sense logically, doesn't it? It doesn't always make perfect sense behaviorally, psychologically, or physically, but it makes no sense who am mortal and changing, try to find refuge in that which is also unstable, mortal, and changing. And so much of this tradition is actually, you know, really learning to find refuge inwardly, learning to find that inwardly generated peace, how to rest in that, and most specifically, you know, really do cultivating the efforts to have a mind and a heart which feels like a friend, that we don't always feel so prone to depart from, you know, that genuinely feels like a friend. And this, you know, this is what our practice is engaged with. This is what bhavana and cultivation is engaged with. Learning to not make an enemy of pain. This is the teaching of dukkha, you know, particularly of the pain of pain. Not to make an enemy of the unpleasant or the uncomfortable or the painful. Learning to befriend rather than to meet with aversion. I think learning not to solidify self. You know, this is the implication of what we know. To really see this as process rather than definition, and to learn to read the signals of selfing. They are so unmistakable. You know, selfing is an energetic surge, in case you hadn't noticed. It's an energetic surge of contractedness, in case you hadn't noticed. And learning to read those signals, and it's a surge that arises, and sometimes it fades away. It usually arises when we're faced with the first ennobling truth that we don't like. It usually arises when we're faced with impermanence and instability. It usually arises in relationship to, you know, unpleasant feeling tones. This is when we feel the surge of selfing. It's a process, it's a surge. We start to learn to read those signals, and we start to, rather than taking those next steps of adding, solidifying, rarefying, how to soften into those surges. We're learning that craving and aversion and fear are not life sentences. And we learn that the only place where kindness and compassion and curiosity are cultivated are in the moments of wakefulness in our lives. And we learn not to leave, I think, the Brahma-Viharas and mindfulness to being accidental encounters, but to being disciplines and commitments. You know, genuine commitments of the heart to that which is liberating. I have covered it. 5 minutes to spare. I've got to the end of what I really wish to communicate. With 5 minutes to spare, well done me. I do thank you for your perseverance and your attention over these couple of days. You've been in for the long haul.